Joseph.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, I use and really highly recommend GoToMyPC to remotely access another computer. You know, maybe you haven't tried GoToMyPC because it seems too complicated. But let me tell you something. It's easy to set up, and it's really easy to use. First, all that you have to do is you have to sign up for a free trial. Go to gotomypc.com/podcast. And make sure that you're at the computer that you want to access it, download it, and set it up. Takes about 2 minutes. Then from any computer you're at, log in to gotomypc.com with your secure password and click the connect button. You can go to mypc and get a 30-day free trial. So visit gotomypc.com/podcast and check it out. I really highly recommend it. Again, it's gotomypc.com/podcast for a free 30-day trial.
Well, hello there. Welcome aboard to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. You're up to episode number 111, and we are ending May on an upbeat tone for the markets. We saw a massive rally inside of 20 minutes. Did you check that out? I mean, it was, as can best be described, as a lackluster day on Friday when there was mixed economic news and really nothing in the way of earnings to see any kind of action that would really drive investors one direction or the other. And then, miraculously, as if out of nowhere, the hand of God comes in and moves the markets up about 1.5%, give or take, in a matter of 20 minutes. That's the S&P 500, the Dow as well, moved up about a little over 1% during that time period. Russell 2000 moved up dramatically, the small caps. And what's really interesting about that is the incredible amount of, whether it's bullishness or bearishness, doesn't really matter, in such a constrained amount of time, 20 minutes. I mean, if you think about it just for a moment, really, just for a second, think about how the good old days, back when markets would move up 1%, would be a big wow. And, you were seeing them really move up at least 1% on a daily basis from top to bottom, no matter what day you pick, any day of the week. It almost seems like, it could even happen on days the market is closed. We see markets moving up and down. But last week was really interesting because was it really the stock market that was driving the stock market? Follow me here for a second. Or was it the bond market and the dollar and oil and commodities that was driving the stock market in varying directions? Now, let me just state for a second that next week I'm going to do a show and we're going to talk about economics. We're going to talk about green shoots and lawnmowers. We're going to talk about some of the things that I've been talking about and look into some of really the as I look at the top-down process, which is one of the first things I'd like to look at to get a long view of where things are going, looking at how we can discern which are the most important economic indicators to look into, to pay attention to, really, and which ones don't mean as much. I mean, is consumer confidence more important than the Philly Fed's number? Is the GDP number the most important number that we're looking at overall, or are we looking at, let's say, the M2 number or the M1 number, or are we looking at chain store sales or whatever else it is? We'll go through some of the highlights of what's important and one of the things that you need to pay attention to, and then I'm going to touch on, because something that's been, I don't want to say troubling me, but it's really mystifying in a way, how we're getting such an incredible amount of revisions to our economic numbers. One of the best jobs in the world has been said to be an economist, because you're paid to be wrong and right. And if you're wrong, you get to readjust and reassess
in order to be right. If you think about it, an economist can make an economic outlook and state that, you know, whatever indicator is going to be up 2% for the year. And then when it comes out, look at it and say, well, it was only up 1.5%. We're going to readjust and, you know, look at our numbers and say the back ones were really needed to be changed and the forward ones needed to be changed. And here we go. Now we're all hunky-dory looking right. But more importantly, the revisions number, which has been the concern here, I want to give you a taste of what I'm talking about, and I want you to think about what I'm saying here. We saw a number of revisions to numbers. Of course, there was clearly mixed economic data from the U.S., and there was clearly some data overseas this week, particularly China, which was raising their GDP numbers. We saw Japan coming in and doing on one hand, a boost to their overall economic outlook, the Japanese government did, and their economic administration, if you will. But at the same time, there were some other numbers that showed a much different story in questioning whether or not the stimulus package internally was to, you know, was the reason why there was so much activity. But, you know, again, on one hand, you have to say it doesn't really matter where the money comes from. It's just money. If it comes in and stimulates the economy, that's where it is. It doesn't matter if it's government or not. The question is, can the economy sustain itself after stimulus is over, after it's shut down? That's the biggest question, of course. You know, it's kind of like putting the choke button on the car, and when you start it up in the old days, you kind of pull the choke button, and you start it, and it warms up, and you let go of the choke button, and all of a sudden it just drops dead. Well, the economies around the world right now are on full choke. And until somebody comes off it, some people are saying that South Korea potentially, Australia potentially, New Zealand may be the first out of this. There's some that are still going into it, it seems. But at the same time, the commodity-rich countries are the ones that are said to be best suited. Brazil, for example, and as an example, Canada, quite possibly. The commodity-rich, the general commodity-rich countries are the ones that will be the first ones out. And we've seen their stock markets in particular rally because so much of that is involved with the natural resources and the materials. We have been investing in that and you know, growing that position over time. We actually just backed off of Mosaic last week. We took a very substantial gain and cut our position finally as we saw the share price starting to fluctuate and the concern about planting seasons, et cetera, getting a little bit questionable. We're kind of at the point where it's a put up or shut up with some of these companies, and a few of them have been starting to show some charting parameters that look very, very toppy. And we felt that it was a good time to take some of that out because we have some of that inside of our other ETFs, such as MOO, M-O-O, that we have an investment in, and that holds a position as well there. But the economic numbers that I'm talking about here are, in particular, last week, I think it was Thursday, the durable goods number came out. Now, that is a really important number, in my opinion, to look at. Because durable goods numbers look at essentially, you know, how much of goods durable, that is the longer lasting. It's not a T-shirt. It's not food, because that can be consumed and easily, you know, finished off, if you will. But the longer lasting, more stable based goods, you know, a washing machine, you know, as an example, bigger ticket items. How are those being bought? And if we see a turn in those, it usually says that people are willing to make more of a commitment to their financial future. Does that make sense? I mean, it's easy enough to buy a $15 T-shirt or $20 T-shirt. But, you know, when you're thinking about buying a refrigerator that might cost you $1,500, it's a whole different discussion. And in fact, here's where the rub is. When you look at the durable goods orders for the most recent release, which was Thursday, and we saw a revision to the prior month, which initially was positive, to a decline of 2.1% in March. And just by simple mathematics, the next thing you look at is what happened here. Well, we had an increase of 1.9% in April. So the headline looked really good that we saw that. But in fact, if you looked a little bit deeper, a little bit behind the headline and maybe a couple paragraphs down, we saw very clearly that the durable goods orders were, in fact, still continuing their slide. Now, let me add one more piece of information here. We can break this down in a lot of different components. As a matter of fact, I'll put this table on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And check that out, because it'll be in the show notes for this episode. But when you look at that and you look at the new orders, which is what we're talking about, and we see this 1.9% increase, we have to look at one of the components, which is non-defense, because now we're talking about the economy. And obviously, you and I are not buying any kind of F-18s or you know, any kind of rifle. Well, maybe, but you know, not for an army. You're not stocking up your ammunition. But when you look at non-defense capital goods new orders, it's still a negative 2% in a change from last month for April. Again, it's showing that we are not expanding on the consumer side of things, even though we did see some movement in some consumer readings. But again, remember, the retail sales came down. Surely consumer sentiment was up nicely the last two readings, but it was really for the future, the hope, and the present situation when we looked at the components behind that were much lower. Anyway, we're going to stop there on that. But next week, I'm going to bring to you a good discussion of this. So make sure to get out pen and paper and make some notes on some of this, because we're going to go back to kind of Economy School 101 and talk about economics and how they really are an important factor in structuring a portfolio from the perspective of we need to look at them for the outlook long term. Clearly, the most relevant for immediate price targeting and buying points, of course, is technical analysis of charts. Fundamental analysis, of course, is important to understand about a company and the strength of them. But economics overall, we'll talk about a domestic or international economy's overall strength and tear apart the components, which then we can make some really good assessments and hopeful long-term predictions on the stock markets and on the economies. Anyway, that aside, I did want to bring up a couple of things that I think you'll find interesting. Today, our guest is a really great guy. His name is Kevin DePue. He's from Minionville. And he specializes in something known as DeMarc indicators. Tom DeMarc is a gentleman who has been devising, we'll call it indicators for some time, many, many years. And for many of you who are avid technical analysis and charting fans and, you know, looking at various oscillators and various indicators and moving averages, this is an entirely different discussion, because what we're looking at with DeMarc indicators is really exhaustion points for whether it's an index, a stock, ETF. All these DeMarc indicators do is help you identify potential, again, we'll say exhaustion points, where you may see a turn. And I think we use DeMarc indicators and actually kind of warming up to them a lot lately, because some of the recent market gyrations have been able to be, identified much more clearly utilizing a non-traditional form of technical analysis. Because sometimes when you look at an oscillator, it all depends on time periods and time frames, if you will. These are kind of the different side of things. It's a bit of a contrarian indicator. And frankly, some of them are spooky in their accuracy. So Kevin DePue is going to come on, talk about some of these things, and we're going to also put some sample charts. These are not available in every technical analysis package. Like, you can't go over to stockcharts.com for the free or paid version and utilize DeMarc indicators. But, for example, Bloomberg, I think TradeStation has either a plugin or something you could buy for that. And there's a few other technical analysis platforms that, in fact, utilize them. But I think you'll have this will be an interesting discussion, because there's a couple questions I want to ask him regarding some of these indicators. Anyway, we'll get to that in a moment. And other than that, I want to mention that one of my favorite indicators from a technical analysis standpoint, long term, kind of out of the box, different than a short term discussion like we talk often about trading and the kind of techniques that we use on this kind of market condition, especially to make sure that you're hedged and you're making sure you're not getting too slammed in any direction. But the 10-month moving average, and particularly the exponential, the EMA, we'll put this chart up also, is a good indication of the longer-term trend of, let's say, markets. Now, we're talking about markets, not individual stocks for a moment. And oftentimes, when you get a indication of a 10-month moving average where we can see that the market is trading above and hopefully on a moving average, the line which is sloping upward. That is an indication of potentially a safer, quote-unquote, safer market to enter into that is trending along its longer-term average. Now, if you look at this chart, and I think you'll find this interesting, you will see that over the last 10 or 15 years, that very clearly the close of the month that we see solidly above or below the 10-month moving average is a fantastic indicator of kind of the next, let's say, midterm for that particular market. And I think if you look at the one we put up there, you'll notice that it did well call the 2002-2003 recovery market rally. And it also did, in fact, indicate very clearly, and if you followed it religiously almost, the market breakdown that happened 2 years ago or a year and a half ago. And right now we are getting very close to breaching that. We'll call it 950 as a number, 955 I think it is, on the EMA. And we like the EMA because it kind of front loads it, or we'll say backloads it. Present conditions are more important there. And I think you'll find that very interesting to look at, that we're getting close to that. Now, a true follower of this would probably wait until the close of the period, the month, before they got fully invested, if you will, because there's plenty of time. Whatever happened yesterday or last week or last month or, you know, last 4 months, regardless of that, there's plenty of time to capture opportunity. And being patient sometimes pays off handsomely. You don't have to worry about, you know, this isn't the whole thing about, oh my God, what am I going to miss? Or what did I do? I mean, this gives you a nice structure, I think, to give you a much more solid base when it comes to general investing, because it will, in my opinion, give you the opportunity to potentially buy a baseline position of broad-based securities and then trade around it in a much more efficient manner and in a way that will give you downside risk protection from another point. We always want to make sure that downside risk, of course, is protected. I call it downside risk mitigation, of course, when it comes to our portfolio. And by the way, we'll close on this but bring in our guest. But if you haven't done the virtual tour, the 14-minute or so virtual tour of the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, and that's where we actually manage money for clients. Not just do a podcast and talk about these things in theory. But if you want to do that, head over there and check it out. Again, I'll put a link on there. It's on the homepage of our website. And do check that out if you're looking for a money manager in this very confusing market and conditions. This is possibly something that you may want to take in consideration. Because also what we do is we have a private blog, which you've never seen, many of you, where we discuss many of the things that are going on, the arbitration options, currency issues, reflection of what our outlook is, town hall meetings. That's all part of it, probably something you've never seen before from advisors out there, because we believe in a nice level of transparency. And when things are good, we'll share what happened. When things are bad, we're going to share that too. And it may not be the prettiest thing, but we're going to share that as well. All right, so let's gear up. Let's get to Kevin DePew from Minionville when we get back here on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And today I brought somebody who I think you're really going to enjoy. He is the executive editor of Minionville. If you haven't looked at Minionville, you need to do it. The home of Hoofy and Boo and just an amazing amount of information. You know, Ms. Shedlock, who comes on here every month, he writes for them, I believe, quite regularly, and they have all sorts of professors and experts that talk about just an amazing amount of information. And if you want to get your kids educated about finance, one of the finest places to venture out to. So, Kevin, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing very well. Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Thanks. Same. Hey, listen, I appreciate you coming aboard here. You have a lot of great things on that side. Let's just kind of go over Minionville for 1 second. I know that you had, this kind of, it's in a way the lighter side of finance, even though you can get into some heavy things. Kind of what's your target there? What are you looking, who are the people you're looking to really target?
Well, I mean, everybody from individuals have an active interest in finance, which for the past year and a half at least has been pretty much everybody, to experienced financial professionals that, face it, Wall Street has made a living for decades on trying to make things, trying to obfuscate things and make things as complex as possible, because that's how your job, that's how they make money. So we try to break through that and take complex financial issues and reduce them to the really simple ideas that they are, because behind every complex CDS or whatever acronym you want to throw out there, there's usually some very simple thing that's trying to be accomplished. So that's kind of our goal, is our mission statement, if you will, is to make complex financial topics understandable to everyday Americans.
Right. I think what you were trying to say was job security for the financial industry. That's why they keep it difficult.
That's exactly right.
You know, you don't want anybody knowing the real secret behind things. But we're going to get into the secret sauce here. Let's talk about something that you have a lot of experience with. I have been checking out. I'm always looking for some interesting aspect of finance that can help us along. Give us a little leg up, a little bit of help. But there's something that maybe people haven't heard about. One thing, let me just preface this. I think there's a lot of people that really, really enjoy using technical analysis charting for the base, if not the sole, way of investing. In other words, they'll find a chart, they'll look at a MACD, they'll look at an RSI, they'll look at a moving average cross, some oscillator. They'll find something that they really like, and they find it works quite well and it gives them some guidance. And there's a couple of reasons I think that. I think it's easier, frankly, than looking at fundamentals. Fundamentals become very difficult. You don't know what kind of financial engineering has gone on. You don't know, you know, what some of these numbers mean, you know, what has to be extracted, what has to be put in, and what's changed, and what comparatives. So I kind of get that. You know, I like to use all the features. I like to use, you know, quant, fund, and techno. That's how we do things. But technical analysis clearly trumps our buying discipline, right? When to buy. So you can have the best fundamentals, but, you know, maybe you have a sector that's bad or a market that's bad. But one of the things that you use a lot is something called DeMarc indicators. Tom DeMarc is a gentleman who a mathematician, I suppose, is the best way to describe him, came up with some great technical analysis, not mainstream at all, but can really help with disciplined trading. Give me your overview on what they are.
Well, Tom DeMarc, as you mentioned, was, I mean, I guess that he might call himself a mathematician, but more so than that, he was fascinated with patterns in the stock market. And, you know, to go back to what you said just a moment ago about technical analysis, on the one hand, it's easier, and it just feels like it's a little bit, there's something less complicated than looking at a stock chart and trying to discern a pattern than trying to uncover something in a company's financial statements, and that's true. But the larger issue is that, you know, because of disclosure regulations, it's really, really difficult to be a fundamental analyst or a fundamental investor and uncover something that other people don't know. Mm-hmm. And the basis for making money in the stock market is relying on behavior of others that is either there's a mistake being made by a vast number of people and that mistake is about to be revealed by the market, or there's some information that you're able to gather that somebody else isn't, you know, within the bounds of legalities. So Tom DeMarc started trying to observe price patterns in the market and found these price patterns that tend to repeat over and over again. And a lot of it, you know, from my standpoint, I think the price patterns that Tom discovered were related to unconscious herding impulses and the natural rhythm in life. That's a very complicated probably a very controversial statement, because it implies that there are things that we do that we feel like we are rational about, but we really aren't rational about at all.
So let me just kind of break that down for a second, because I think that could be said in another way and to bring it back to what people can relate to, because there are, we know for a fact, there are mathematical patterns in life. And some of them, when people look at technical analysis, we look at Fibonacci retracements and Fibonacci numbers. And you look at, you know, where the shells, the sequence of numbers in a shell and the patterns in a shell and in other sequences seem to have the same exact number sequences over and over again. Is that what you're kind of getting at?
Absolutely, Andrew. I mean, I think that most of us would agree, without having to get into too many of the controversial aspects, you could agree very simply that there is a natural rhythm to life, a natural progression, a natural sequence that tends to reoccur over and over again. Mm-hmm. And that's true whether we're talking about the shells, it's true whether we're talking about fractal patterns that are observable from the shoreline down to a grain of sand, or patterns that play out in the market.
So, DeMarc looks at these, or at least he thinks there's something here, and he looks at the a stock or a market or some marketable security, and he looks to see how and if there is a pattern that is, let's call it, repeatable or identifiable, maybe is even better. And now one of them that he has a lot of them, and he's coming out with some new ones actually very, very shortly. I saw some of them recently. One of them that he looks at is a sequential counter. So in essence, there is a count, again, back to the number sequence and the pattern. there's a number count of up or down, let's call it. You know, kind of take us through that, the 9 and 13, this kind of sequencing.
Well, all you're doing is comparing consecutive price bar closes. And so the reason you would do this is that if you believe that there is some kind of natural pattern that reoccurs, then by comparing those price bar closes, you can identify patterns that are repeated in the market over and over again. That's what Tom found many, many years ago, 30 years ago, I think, or more. And he's coded this, and so if you use Bloomberg system or CQG or some of those other trading systems, those indicators are available within those formats. And all he's trying to do is identify potential exhaustion zones in the market, where there are where the buyers have simply run out, or conversely, where the sellers have simply exhausted themselves. And he calls those exhaustion zones. That makes pretty much intuitive sense. The indicator you're talking about is called the TD sequential, for TD, Tom DeMarc, sequential. And it's really the foundation of, I believe, Tom's work, and it's the foundation of my work with DeMarc indicators. And the reason it's important is because it addresses the problem that most traders have. When you're using technical analysis, the vast majority of technical analysis tools are designed to either identify momentum breakouts or trending. And so what Tom has done is combine this into one indicator that addresses the problem of both momentum, that's the setup phase of TD sequential, and trending, which is the countdown phase of TD sequential.
So here's what happens. So my understanding, correct me anytime when I'm way off here, but my understanding is like the TD sequential is a 9-bar count. It has to be consecutive bars. That one bar is, let's call it, let's talk about the downside for a moment, that each bar that you referenced, the close today, is lower than the close 4 bars ago, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so this goes on, and it counts to 9 consecutively as long as that statement is true.
That's right.
When you get to that end point, that 9 number, let's say, at that point, whether, again, it's an up or down, you can use it on either side, it's considered to be an exhaustion point.
That's correct.
Okay, and at that point, you could do one of two things. There's a couple different ways to do this, but let's just keep it easy, that the next day on the open, you would buy. Some people do the close at that point, but there's different ways to do it. But let's just call that possibly a buy or sell trigger.
Sure.
Okay? So let's talk about, though, the next point when you get into the trend. That's a 13 count, right?
That's right. The reason we're concerned about trend is because, you know, it's one thing to be someone who is a mean reversion trader.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do that from a system standpoint, or you can do that just as a day trader, whatever. I'm a position trader, so I tend to hold positions for longer term, and I focus on longer term, the monthly charts and weekly, and I'll even go to quarterly charts.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason we're concerned about the trend is we want to understand that at what point, if there is exhaustion, is it temporary, or is it just or is it the indication of a new trend or a breakup? That's the momentum phase. And so once you go to countdown, then you no longer require, you know, the trend. If you draw a trend line on a chart in an amateurish way, you can connect different bottoms if it's an uptrend. You can say, oh, I see the trend.
Mm-hmm.
Well, those periods where the trend is moving down to touch that line that you're drawing, is that the start of a new trend, or is it just a pause?
Right.
And so this gives us a way to quantify that and to understand what the count is. Those bars on the 13 countdown that you're talking about, those do not have to be consecutive, and you're comparing the close to the low 2 price bars earlier in the case of a buy signal, or you're comparing it to the close to greater than the low 2 price bars earlier for a sell signal.
So now, would you say that the 13th point would be considered a buy on the downslope? So in other words, it's a let's just also clarify this point, I think. It's a contrary indicator.
That's right.
So
that's
when you look at traditional analysis, you would look at things, and oftentimes you would look at a chart and you say, okay, here's a trend I'm going to buy because the trend is continue. Oftentimes, here we're saying something totally different because it doesn't look like a trend that's at all identifiable for let's say a bullish trend, because actually what's happening is you're seeing a horrible bear situation set up.
That's right.
You know, it's almost counterintuitive.
Well, it is. And if you think about, most people think that, I think if you would ask the retail investor, certainly what their perception of what happens when a market tops or what happens when a market bottoms, they would talk about, well, for some reason it became apparent and everybody decided to sell at the market top. Well, that's not really true. What Tom believes and what I believe is that markets top because there are simply no more buyers left, and they bottom when there are simply no more sellers left. If you think of one of the fascinating things, just to back up for a moment, about the MARC indicators is that they're valid across multiple timescales. And so that gives you a way to determine if you're a day trader what the context of the situation in which you're trading is based on larger timescales. If you view markets as wars between competing timeframes, then it becomes more apparent how this could possibly happen, because you have, when you go to the market and you enter a sell or a buy order with the person that you're dealing with, then that actually goes out. It has to go to somebody else who's taking the opposite position.
Right.
So
right.
Why might they be doing that? Well, it could be the case that you're 60 years old and you decided, you know what, I need to start moving my money into other different, you know, into other places because of my time frame, whereas somebody you're selling to might be 35 years old and thinking, you know, I don't care if we go down 20% from here, I'm gonna look at this 30 years from now and see where we are. So those wars between competing time frames are what allows markets to take place.
You know what just hit me?
What's that?
You know, if you think about this, kind of combining some Harry Dent work here, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with him, demographics, I mean, just for a moment, I wonder if there's any been real studies done about the relationship to an aging population and the amount and the relationship of let's just call it core equity index and equity, because you would think that if the general rule is to obviously generally loosen up equities and drop equity exposure as you get older, to the point of retirement and older, and or let's just say reduce risk is better said, that you would think that an aging population a la Japan would naturally have less equities in their portfolios, just as a course of, you know, appropriate advice.
Well, that's one way to look at it, but Andrew, another way to look at it might be that at what, you know, what determines what that, how that risk is going to be perceived. You know, just as an example, if you are 55 years old and the year is 1997, then you're going to have a much different view of risk than someone who's 55 years old right now.
Right.
And so what determines what those time preferences are? Because that's all we're talking about on the larger scale. When you remove the shorter-term traders and you look at what happens when somebody chooses to buy an equity or buy stock in a company, what decision is being made, then it's about time preferences and how soon do you need your money. If your time preferences are extended and your risk appetite is therefore larger, then your decision is that, you know what, the money is more valuable to me several years from now than it is right now. If your time preferences are shortened, then your risk appetites are decreased, then you're going to be more likely to view equities as too risky for where you are right now because you need the money sooner.
Right. You know what's fascinating about the DeMarc, by the way, just to fill in a little bit, so they have the, we'll call it the 9-13 to keep it easy, the sequential and the countdown, but there's another, I don't know, I'm just going to say around number 20 indicators that are actually separate and apart that can be used. There's a combo, there's a camouflage, there's a moving average. Again, these are different. He actually has one that is, it's a wave, they call it, but it's very similar, if not almost identical to an Elliott wave concept. But it also combines some, in addition to this Elliott wave looks at price only, I believe that the DeMarc indicator for Elliott wave looks at price and time considerations, right? Is that correct?
Right. That's right.
What's interesting is I don't think I have some people I know that are really into the whole Elliott wave thing and all that, but they oftentimes draw it out by hand.
Yes.
This is actually interestingly almost right on for the Elliott wave. It's kind of fascinating how well it does a job at creating the various major points on the Elliott wave as well as the ABC fractals.
And all of these indicators, what, you know, they're usually trying to solve a couple of questions, because I mean that's how Tom approaches this he and his staff at you know are always looking at as you know, you and I think participate in some things on Bloomberg that mm-hmm. Tom's heavily involved in. You know, right. That his staff is always looking at answering questions about the markets, and usually the questions are related to price. Mm-hmm. Trending, momentum, or time considerations.
Right.
And most of the technical tools we have can answer one of those questions, but it's hard to come up with a methodology that answers all of those questions,
right.
or at least resolves questions about momentum and price versus time And the time component is critical, and all of us can identify points where, you know, we bought stocks or purchased or sold something, and really we were right longer term, but the timing was
right.
Poor.
So, way off, right on timing, exactly. So do you, I don't know if there's probably different answers for different positions, but do you usually pull the trigger on a 9, or do you usually wait for a 13? Because sometimes you don't see both.
Right. Well, it depends. And as far as the position trading that I do that makes up the core of my strategy, I usually wait for the 13s. And, you know, the reason is that I'm trying to match those up with a thesis that I have. For example,
right.
If the thesis is, you know, deflation, or if the thesis has something to do with raw materials, then I want to look for situations where people are saying that no one is ever going to use copper again. Or, you know, back in 2002, that no one was ever going to apparently buy an oil service company.
Mm-hmm.
And then I want to match those up by saying, well, something must be going on here fundamentally, that everybody's selling these stocks, but I'm getting these DeMarc indicators showing that things are reached true exhaustion across quarterly, monthly, weekly time frames.
Yep.
So those are the situations that I look for where people are gathering around a situation that has either become exhausted on the upside or ignoring a situation that's becoming exhausted on the downside.
I mean, clearly I think that everybody that's listening can agree that the whole idea of exhaustion, because the whole 9-13 thing to some people may seem a little bit like, you know, astrology or some other kind of phenomenon. But I got to tell you something. If you ever sat down and took a stock or a market and just on a daily chart, let's say, it's a little spooky. It's a little spooky how well this works. Not all the time, clearly, and you have to follow the rules. But generally speaking, one of the things that I think it probably blew me away the most was when you see a 9 and a perfected 9, of course, you know, you see one that's called a 9, you get a 9 count, and you get, let's say, call it the signal. And let's say that it marks an exhaustion point for a downside, so in other words, a buy signal almost. It's almost spooky how the next day it moves up.
It really is, and there are, you know, it's nothing's 100% perfect, and there are plenty of situations where you'll get some things that have worked in the past won't work in the future for all of a sudden, and you know you're wondering why that is. But hey, as Tom himself says, it's better than guessing. So.
Yeah. No, it definitely gives you that, because I think that particularly in this market environment, I don't know if that's what we can call this, but this mishmash.
Right.
Of daily movement that is, trade, I guess, I don't even know what to call trade the news. It's more like panic at the news, you know, because we've seen several times in the last few weeks, you know, an economic number or some kind of announcement come out that has clearly been short covering, let's say, to just push things up like crazy. And not saying that the market needs to either go up or down, but, you know, some of the things that we're seeing could be identified in a way by some of these exhaustion points. At least I've seen that. And I think that I agree with you that using multiple time frames as a confirmation point is a very interesting way to utilize this. So do you use fundamentals at all in terms of the individual securities?
I do, to the extent that, look, I want to make sure that the company I'm buying is relatively solvent, some fundamental metrics that make sense.
So you're staying away from banks?
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
Staying away from banks. But, you know, and then I take some positions longer term, and I'm looking to take some positions longer term in some commodities. As an example, Andrew, just to tell you, you know, what I'm looking at right now, on a monthly chart, silver has just recorded a TD sequential 13 for this month.
Mm-hmm.
It's a monthly chart. That's a very long-term chart.
Right.
So that once we get a valid TD sequential sell signal, then there's what we refer to as the 12-bar metric. So we would expect 12 bars after that where silver reacts to the downside now after having had a decent move up.
So let me interrupt you for a second. Let me make this clear to everybody, because now we're talking about a different type of trading. It's called patience. Because
that's right.
In order for you to get to this point, think about this, you had to have 9 months of consecutive bars that were met this criteria, and so you're saying so now, and then you have 13, but the 13 don't have to be consecutive. So if you're looking at that right now, tell me how many bars in total are we looking at here?
We got a couple of trading days left in the month of May. So silver is going to register a TD sequential sell signal for the month of May.
Mm-hmm.
So considering that would have 12 months to react to the downside, that would be a year of probably some kind of erosion in silver prices. Now, when I apply another TD or DeMarc indicator, which is just it's similar to the to Fibonacci retracement, then I have a downside target of silver somewhere below $10 an ounce. So that's a significant decline from where it is now. And the reason I bring this up is because the mad craze now is gold. Everybody is there's almost a near certitude on from whether it's famous investors we're all familiar with that are involved in the commodity space saying that the dollar is going to go to zero and gold's going to go to $25,000 an ounce. Maybe it will. I don't know. But when I look at gold in DeMarc terms, it's not telling me that. It's telling me that what I want to buy is silver below $10 an ounce, and gold is probably going to go to somewhere above 1,000 here in the next few months. After that, though, if you had to pick a winner, gold versus silver, silver to me looks like it's going to be the winner, and that's based on the DeMarc work I do.
So wait a minute, just to kind of get this, you got a buy signal on the silver?
Well, I have a sell signal on the silver on a monthly chart, but once that sell signal resolves itself, looking at longer-term charts like a quarterly chart, for example, silver is much more bullish, and it's something that somewhere around between $8 and $9 an ounce on silver, I would want to be a very big buyer there.
Is this also what you're telling me is that you don't short?
No, I don't, because it's just not, as a position trader, there are too many things that you have to be willing to ride, so many moves that can go against you. And I'm just not in favor of taking positions where your upside is limited to 100% and your downside is unlimited if you just happen to be on vacation for an extra week or something and don't have access to a phone or something.
So that's a good thing. So now the point is, so let me just back up one point. I just want to ask you something. So just my main question was, when did your 9-count sequential bar number one start?
On the monthly chart?
Yep.
You have to go back. The 9 bar started, let me just scroll back here on my screen. The 9 bar for this particular count began on September 30th of 2005.
Right.
That's on a monthly chart.
So here's my patience factor that I'm trying to explain now. I mean, so now this isn't the only thing you're watching, counting the days till this happens, of course. But, obviously you've been patient, or you're going to be patient enough through this thing to have at least 9 plus 13, of course, on a monthly basis to find that zone, which, this can be done daily. Do you think the DeMarc indicators can be done intraday, by the way, like the 9, 13s?
Absolutely. I know that there are probably more people who use it intraday than there are people who use it for position trading.
Right, right. I've actually, again, been flabbergasted to see how well that turns. It's either that it works so well or everybody's following the same thing, you got to figure. So what's your outlook here? When you're looking now at the DeMarc indicators, let's kind of just skip right over to, let's just go to the S&P 500. As you're looking at that, whether it's the 9-13 sequential countdown indicator, maybe a wave, maybe a retracement. I mean, what are you seeing there from a DeMarc technical look
on the S&P 500?
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, I'll go out to look at the quarterly chart first, because what I'm looking for is multiple time frame alignment.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, we're talking about DeMarc indicators in terms of being able to define both momentum and trend.
Right.
On a quarterly basis, the S&P 500 remains in a negative trend. You've had, on a quarterly basis, one bar now, if we count this quarter that we're currently in, one bar where the it was a positive quarter.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, you had five bars in a row where there were five negative quarters in a row for the S&P 500 on a price basis. But there was a qualified break of a TD sequential TDST support line that was at 960.84, and that qualified break occurred in December of 2008, for the fourth quarter of 2008. So that tells me on a quarterly basis the trend is still down, and what I'm looking for here on a quarterly basis is at least three more quarters where we can get a potential 9 buy signal. The last time on the quarterly chart that we had this perfected 9 buy setup, not buy signal setup, I mean, the last time we had this buy setup was the fourth quarter of 2002, which ended up to be a very, that was a terrific time to go against the trend, and in spite of looming war in Iraq and all these negative things that were going to be happening, crude oil at $1 million a barrel, that was a good time based on did the MARC indicators to start exploring the shorter time frames. And then when you go down to a monthly basis, we had a buy, a perfected buy setup in February of this year, which took a little time to work, but now here we are three bars past that. And so I'm looking for probably another month of positive action. There's some probability that we get above 1,000 or at least up to 945 or 950. And then I think that the quarterly chart is going to reassert itself, and it might be the case. My thesis is that the fourth quarter of this year is going to be much worse than what people think. I believe that most people are beginning to anticipate some kind of nice turnaround in the fourth quarter of 2009, and I don't think that's going to materialize, or at least the market is going to it may materialize in the economy, but not the stock market.
So let's skip the quarter. What happened to the third quarter?
Third quarter, we're still, we don't really have to do anything from an indicator standpoint, because remember when we're looking at the price bar for the fourth quarter, we'll look back four bars, mm-hmm. and that'll be the low point there is 1106.42. So it's a remote probability that we get above that. That would erase the potential nine sell or buy setup that's working. So
right.
I think it's remote that's going to happen. It could happen. Anything could happen. But.
Yeah, one of the things that, just as a side note here, just to talk about just the fundamentals for a moment, we're seeing that there's a lot of discussion about, the economy. I was talking about the economy separate from the market for a moment. You know, coming out of its, negative growth, third quarter or so, and getting to some very, kind of tepid growth from there. There's, they talk about the U's, the L's. The latest one we're hearing is the square root setup. Have you seen that?
I don't think so.
It's actually kind of interesting. If you can envision doing a square root sign,
mm-hmm.
And that's the economic potential for the economic recovery. So in other words, you got, big down and up, and then we got the down, and now we're kind of somewhere up there. Then we get the up, and then we get the flat.
The flat, right.
Which is kind of a different setup than the U and all, because, the question is, how do we get a U with a kind of continuation or a V with a continuation if we don't have all that money from consumers, et cetera, with loans and, housing values and HELOCs and all that. But anyway, I digress. But the interesting thing is that plays well into the theory that companies can continually cut expenses to make up for EPS, or make EPS, let's call it, financial engineering of sorts, up to a point. So up to a point, you can only have one person working at Office Depot. I mean, you have to have some staff, you have to have some inventory, et cetera. So there's only a certain point where you can do that. So that would kind of work with the fourth quarter discussion.
Well, it does, and I think even from a larger macroeconomic standpoint, I think people are underestimating the impact of the deflationary debt unwind. And I know that Mark Favre today on Bloomberg, or yesterday, said that there would be hyperinflation with 100% certainty on his part.
I think he said something to the extent of Zimbabwe style.
Exactly. and I don't disagree with that longer term, but I think that his view on that must be longer than mine, because for the reasons that you cited, people are underestimating the depth and severity and the change in social mood that still lies ahead of us, and that's very deflationary. All these forces are very deflationary. And too often, I think people confuse absolute price movement with being indicators of inflation or deflation. Those are merely symptoms of it. And
well, I think he's been on the show, by the way. Nice fellow. He, very obviously to the extreme, basically, has had a very negative, look at the dollar, and maybe rightfully so. But I think he's just simply, very simply, just looking at impact of this expenditure, how much more has to happen,
right.
And just kind of talk about this rampant runaway inflation with the assumption that there is no way that the Fed can take themselves out of it. And basically, you see, it's a double-edged situation here. On one hand, if things don't get better, they got to keep on pushing it down. So if they push it down, and how does that become inflationary? It's a very odd situation, because especially that when we're talking inflation also, and particularly in here, I mean, what goods are we really dealing with? We have to. It's a global goods issue now that we're assembling with.
Well, that's right, and for there to be some kind of hyperinflationary event, there has to be at least one currency, one country out there that matches up better than the United States on a global basis. I don't see that. I don't know who it would be. Zimbabwe is very easy to see that. You know, I could see that if the United States were somehow divided into six different regions, there would be a number of regions already that would probably be experiencing some degree of hyperinflation.
Mm-hmm.
But when, you know, we're still the largest economy, we're still responsible for a vast majority of consumption in the world. And I just don't, all of these things that are happening, the contraction in credit, you know, the unavailability of credit, combined with the lack of desire to take on more credit, more importantly, these are all deflationary things, and they haven't run their course. And so now we're either going to have a situation where the market's going to stay where it is for a long time so that, that price can be resolved and real savings can be accumulated, or dramatically lower prices are going to have to come sooner rather than later so that that issue of value versus savings can be resolved.
You know, it's interesting because there's so many things to talk about this topic, but what's really fascinating is, and you talk about social change and the idea of you know, kind of, I guess, this the major event that we've recently seen readjusting social priorities, right?
Absolutely.
I would just say one thing. I just want to ask one thing. It seems to me that already I'm finding, just, you know, from an anecdotally, that how soon we forget what happened just recently. And risk appetite already in Phoenix. I heard there's a feeding frenzy on real estate in Phoenix already.
That's right. I was reading about that just the other day, you know, where, you know, it's, you know, it's when we talk about these things, and I write a lot about social mood and socionomics. And, you know, when I write about it, my wife even sometimes, you know, grabs me by the collar and says, what are you talking about? Because I'm just dying to go shopping and buy these shoes. And you wrote last week that there's this fundamental shift in consumption habits, and it made it seem as if no one was going to ever buy shoes that cost more than $50 ever again.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, you know, again, we're talking about multiple timescales, and these are very long-term secular shifts. I mean, invert it for a moment, if you will, and think about the last significant recession we had, 91, 92.
Mm-hmm.
There were changes in consumption that were very temporary. And so what we would say about that, from, you know, the benefit of hindsight and looking back, is that there was a cyclical downturn in consumption that was being fueled by a larger secular consumption trend.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what's changed this time is that we're going to see cyclical rebounds in consumption, but the longer-term trend is for a return to a more austere and more modest view of consumer goods and the things that we actually need.
Right. Well, what's interesting about that, and the thing that – I'm on your team on that one, by the way, and I do agree with this, but one of the things that keeps on hitting me right in the head is two things: retail and casual dining.
Right.
I mean, it's like nothing ever happened. You know, casual dining is just going through the roof. There's a little blip in there, don't get me wrong, but, and then retail, for the most part, I mean, there's a couple of things here and there, but it's like the stocks don't reflect this at all. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think that in terms of when we're talking about retail, retailers, they were beaten down pretty severely. Then we had some mean reversion, but they all look exactly the same as, mm-hmm. as the S&P 500, and I'm talking about on the quarterly basis and the longer term charts. In fact, the one of the things that reinforces what, you know, I guess this would be my deflationary thesis, that we still have to have much lower prices. One of the things that reinforces that is when you're dealing with a longer term debt unwind and debt deflation, there are no assets that are safe. There's nothing that you can buy that will protect you from that. Your goal is to lose less than the guy next to you, so that when we emerge from it, you have some means with which to buy things
mm-hmm.
again.
Mm-hmm.
And so until we get separation where it's not the case that retailers look the same as biotechs, which look the same as semiconductor stocks, which look the same as transport stocks on these long-term quarterly charts, maybe that won't happen until 2010, late 2010. Until that begins to happen, then we won't be able to say that something is fundamentally changing in the economy. We're seeing cyclical rebounds right now. I think we're involved in one, but that's different. It's not the same thing. The parameters have changed, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, and the fact is, Kevin, if things don't change, if they're not either forcibly changed, a la credit card issues and use of HELOCs, things like that, we are going to end up right back to this far worse in a very short period of time.
Well, there's no question about it. I mean, something, you know, has to change, and I think that's part of what I've been trying to chronicle in the Five Things column that I write for Minionville is this ongoing shift. Because, I've been writing about it for a long time. In 2005, I was writing about the demise of so-called bling culture, and which is, it made it into the Wall Street Journal just the other day about, rappers are suddenly finding that they can't pursue the culture of bling because there's not enough money out there to pay them what they were getting even 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we adjust to that? Do they decide that normally from a psychological basis, when we run up against the limits of our capacity to service our debt, the limits of spending, at that point we pull back, which is painful psychologically. So what are some of the tactics that we use to deal with that? As human beings, we begin to associate with people who are closer to our socioeconomic status. And as part of that, we begin to find ways to vilify those or to mock those who have things that we don't, to make ourselves feel better. It's a natural thing to do. But when the vast majority of people in the country are starting to move to that point, that's when you have a social shift where mm-hmm. things begin to change. And so it's no longer cool to be the rapper that has the $25,000 watch on. And what's cool is the rapper who doesn't have any watch. And so you see things mirrored in pop culture all the time, and I think the difference is that these are structural changes; they're not cyclical changes.
Right. Maybe they'll clean up their language and talk about something other than sex and drugs, so my kids don't have to constantly listen to that and think it's okay. But on a separate note, sorry, let's just finish up on the forward look here. So, then what I got out of your conversation about the quarterly charts into the monthly charts on the S&P 500, if I could decipher that, is from what you're seeing. Again, I'm just trying to understand this. You're seeing that you don't necessarily see I don't want to say the bottom calling, but you don't see necessarily a total shift to a bullish maneuver right now, long-term staying there and just we're on our way. Is that a correct statement?
That's right. I think we're within a window of about 3 to 5 weeks where the market will still want to go up, and then those buyers will be exhausted and will begin to start to shudder again about something.
Hmm. Interesting. Do you have any targets on that? Is that giving you any kind of numbers, or is that something that's really, at this point, questionable?
Well, it's still questionable at this point. I'm not in the camp that says that we definitively have to go down and make a new low.
Right.
But I am in the camp that I think it's probable that we go down and at least test the last low.
Hmm.
From there, at one point, there was the possibility that we go below 600. I still think that, even if you're looking at some more modest valuations for the S&P 500, there's some fundamental probability that we go down to 600. But at that point, as I wrote back, in March on Minionville, that if your time frame is longer than 5 or 10 years, then you want to start being a buyer. The next 600 points from the 600 level, are by definition going to be up.
Exactly.
Or I think it's going to zero.
Right, unless it can come down a little bit, but generally what you're saying is that in the big picture, if it does go down a little bit, that now it's starting to split hairs over the long term.
Well, yeah, and I don't want to do that. I'm not trying to squeeze, a 15% move down or a 20% move down from here on the short side to squeeze that blood from that stone. What I'm looking for is, again, the different sectors of the market begin to break away from the all-one market deflationary debt unwind nightmare where everything's going down. And so you'll see some sectors begin to make higher lows when we get another retest. And that's what I'm looking for, because I'm looking for reasons to be bullish now. The time for being bearish is over. And the point of what I write on Minionville is not to be bearish, but to be realistic and to understand that, if the market were to go back to 700, say, if we're having this conversation 5 years later and the market's at 1,000, those have been pretty good years. Those have been pretty good normalized return years for the stock market.
Right. But, I mean, you got to say that you are being bearish if you're thinking that it could go down from here and that the probability, in your view right now, is not going up. So short term, you have to say you're bearish, looking for the bullish point to entry.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, I hear you. All right. Well, I mean, there's a lot to absorb. I'm going to put a couple of we'll put some links right to your articles and to things that you're writing on the show notes, but also we'll put a couple of examples maybe of a couple of different components of what we're talking about right now. So when people hear us and they're like, what are these guys talking about the DeMarc indicators? Because I think it's kind of cool that there's it's not the most easily available, but if you have the right tools, whether it's, as you mentioned, Bloomberg or TradeStation or some of the other places that you can look, it's kind of interesting in some of the components on how to you know, understand and the books that are available on this. I think it does, like you said, put a different twist on things, and it makes it a little bit more disciplined, I guess is the right word to use. Another tool in your belt, I guess, right?
That's right. Now, I can send you some. I'll send you some examples of charts that we've talked about to give people an idea. Maybe you can link to it, and they can
that'd be great.
Pull up those charts.
That'd be great. And great work on the Hoofy and Boo, by the way. Always gives me a big laugh and over at Minionville. And just to mention everybody also that we are in the presence of an Emmy Award winner. Kevin won in December of 2008, just around right back a few months back. He won an Emmy from the National Academy of Television and Arts and Sciences for his role as the writer and producer of Minionville's World in Review, the first and only animated business news show. This stuff is it fortunately puts a little bit of fun in the finance, which sometimes right now some people, I don't know about you, but I know people that don't even want to talk about it these days.
You know, well, sometimes all you can do is laugh.
Yeah.
We certainly have found ample things to make fun of with Hoofy and Boo over the past year and a half.
Yeah, you have. I love the Starbucks one, by the way.
Okay.
That one is hysterical. I mean, amongst others, but that one, not, you know, just hysterical. Kevin DePew, Minionville, thank you so much for joining us on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Andrew.
I was going to wrap it up for today, and I'm going to make sure to put some of those DeMarc charts we talked about, the sequential and the countdowns, on the website, and just go over there to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And next week, don't forget, we're going to talk about economics. We have a potpourri of information I've been putting together, and I think you'll really enjoy what we have put together, and it'll give you a good education. Till next time, thanks for joining us on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.